Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. George Saunders is renowned for his 6 collections of short stories and novellas and his nonfiction essays. His most recent work, 10th of December Stories, was reviewed for the New York Times Magazine with the headline, George Saunders has written the best book you'll read this year. The collected stories are dark yet funny, desperate yet hopeful. His characters teeter on the brink of doom, but write themselves to a place of stillness. In 2000, The New Yorker named him one of the best writers under 40. He writes regularly for The New Yorker and Harper's, as well as Esquire, GQ, and The New York Times Magazine. He teaches at Syracuse University, and it is a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. It's quite a thrill to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Do you quite understand what it is about your particular brand of writing and about this collection that has struck a chord with readers?
I do not, actually. I have thought about it. I have a feeling it might be like in that Fitzgerald thing where someone said, how did you go broke? And the guy said, gradually and then all at once. Like I could feel the last couple of years getting a little bigger crowds, you know, and then, of course, that New York Times piece was huge, you know, so I'm not really sure. It seems like just kind of a great, enjoyable thing, but I can't really explain it.
Do you think that New York Times piece would have been different had it come out in August or October? The fact that it came out in the first week of January and said, this is the best book you'll read all
year. Yeah, it was kind of, it was a sort of an ornery throwdown. You know, as the recipient, you have to sort of just laugh because it's going to make energy, no question about it. So I think if just everybody would just agree not to read anything for the rest of the year, we could protect the unimpeachability of the Times.
When you start to write something like this, is it always in the guise of, I want to write these stories so they will become a collection? Or is it always the individual story first?
It's even smaller. I mean, usually it's just some nugget, some fragment of a story that I'm working on, trying to get it to kind of reveal itself a little bit. So it'll be, at any given time, you know, maybe I have 4 pages, and I'm not sure where it goes. Maybe it's even 2 different stories. And so for me, the big challenge is to resist that urge to figure out what it is too early and just kind of mess with it. It's weird because if I do that, the story will sprout some kind of tendril that will start to look like plot, and then it'll allow itself to grow. But if I put the cart before the horse and start deciding things in advance, I usually end up wasting a lot of time. So for me, the challenge is to stay out of it as much as I can, kind of respect the text and just let it accrete on its own.
There is a limit to the growth of that tendril just by the sake that it's a short story, though.
Yeah. My thought is that, you know, the subconscious, I'm not sure I use that word correctly, but whatever it is, it's just below your conceptual mind, is really, really smart, incredibly hyper-organized and insightful. So for me, the trick is to get the conceptual part of it off to the side if I can and just say, you know, whatever I write during the next X years, I'm going to assume that there's a controlling wisdom in the way that those stories appear and get completed. And at the end of some period, when it feels right, I just look at what I have and say, yeah, you don't actually belong in this collection. Sorry, you're out. Maybe I need a little something extra. It's really kind of intuitive, just sort of feeling your way towards something that feels like a complete set and then reordering that to taste. And I'm not a real big high concept writer.
You choose the order.
I obsess over the order. I just usually get some index cards and kind of lay out one for each story with the first and last line, and then just start moving around and try to see, you know, really with the idea of almost like a carnival ride, you know, like you'd want to come in with something that would get some attention, and then for the middle, just build a series of experiences that are, you know, a pleasure burst, then maybe something a little more contemplative, and then maybe something really contemplative, and about the time the reader's going to check out, you do another pleasure burst. And so it's really kind of like, I think maybe like putting an album together. The real goal is you don't want anybody to walk away.
Billy Collins explained that to me, the poet, the exact same way of having the cards and putting them out on the floor and waking up in the middle of the night and kind of changing them around and going back after thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing because I think as someone who teaches writing, we often think about these artistic decisions as if they must be sort of very logical and intellectual. And in my experiences, they're more seat of the pants, maybe like cooking to taste or something where if you learn to trust your on-the-spot intuitions, you can put 1,000 of those in order or, you know, put 1,000 of those together in a book, and they actually mean bigger than you could have meant in advance. The idea is that you're actually kind of in charge of spontaneity and then organizing a bunch of these spontaneous events into a book.
Is there a point where the limit of a short story makes it more magical?
that's a great description of the form, you know, that it's so short and it's the expectations are so high, and the risk of failure is high, because if you fail in a story, everybody knows it. You know, you can kind of feel that disappointed, ugh, you know, the air goes out of the room. So I think, like telling a joke or maybe writing a pop song, you're committing to the constraint of time, and that sort of ups the ante, I think, in a really delicious way.
How did you find the form of short story?
I think it was mostly just, that's what I was reading. I was a big Hemingway fan. I loved In Our Time. I was aware that I had a very limited talent, and I also wasn't very well read. I'd been an engineering student. So I thought, well, it must be easier if it's shorter, you know, so I'll try 2 pages, try 3 pages. And then I went to the grad program in Syracuse, and at that time in the 80s, and now too, actually, the story is really kind of the easiest thing to teach in a workshop. So we were reading a lot of those. And I just kind of fell in love with Hemingway and de Maupassant and Isaac Babel. You know, sometimes you just find something that thrills you. And when I was in my 20s, the idea of being known as a story writer just seemed so glamorous to me. You know, it seemed cooler than anything. So really, I just kind of got on that. And I think, like a lot of people, I thought, well, I'll train with the short story to go to the real thing, which is a novel. And I never really found that jump to be necessary or natural. The story still is so hard, you know, so fascinating.
Tobias Wolff was
your teacher. Tobias Wolff was my teacher, yeah, yeah.
What do you learn from a mind like that?
Oh, man. Well, the main thing that I learned was to read the stories and see how subtle and layered and powerful and intentional they are, and read them many, many times. And then the added bonus of studying with him was you could walk out and look at him, and you could see how he behaved with his family, and you could see the way he taught. I don't think I'd ever had a feeling of how much you could do with craft, with discipline and hard work. So then to see those beautiful stories, that they were actually connected to a physical human being who wasn't levitating above the earth, you know, but you knew that something he was doing in those 4 or 5 hours of writing was making him a great writer. So that was encouraging to me, because he was a wonderful guy. He wasn't I thought writers had to be wild people and kind of rude, and he was just an exemplary, wonderful human being. But somehow he was getting magic to happen, and you had to conclude it was just work, you know, which I took a lot of consolation in that I didn't have to be a biker or kind of a ninja, and you just had to go in your room for 4 or 5 hours and do whatever it was he was doing in there.
Do you still, though, in the writing, search for a novel and think, oh, this may be it?
Sometimes, sure. Yeah, I think there's part of everybody a big 700-page thing would be great. What I try to do is search for whatever's there. And certainly, sometimes your mind goes, this is it, man. You did, you know, you finally turned the corner. But the beauty of this approach of coming in every day and kind of starting over is that at some point, if it's not, your mind will tell you. You get to page 40 and you'll find yourself dozing off and you realize that you've misidentified this thing. So for me, the whole thing is to kind of be really grateful if anything happens at all. And that in turn will make you kind of willing to give up the novel if it's not a novel, you know. Or on the other hand, you know, if someday it happens, then you'll be there to receive it. I think the proper sort of stance for me is sort of hopeful and grateful. You know, I'm really happy to be an artist at all. Please, oh story God, will you give me one paragraph today, and don't get too greedy.
You used the word intentional a moment ago in the writing of a story, of it being intentional. And I assume when you write, we'll come out and we can analyze it and say, oh, this is a story about separation and loss and solace.
Right.
But that isn't intentional going in saying, I'm going to write about these.
No, I mean, I've done it, and it just usually doesn't work out, because the danger is it'll just be that thing. You'll say, I'm going to write a story about solace. And then 4 paragraphs in, the reader is super smart, and she'll say, oh, you're writing a story about solace. So there's something much more exciting about the story form, which is that you don't know what it is, you know, and you're hoping it's going to be something, and you're hoping that when it announces what it is, you won't miss the signal. And so the thrill is the reader is there with you. Neither one of you really knows what this journey is going to wind up to be. So that's pretty high wire stuff, and it's fun. And it's also, there's respect built in. If you and I are on this thing together, I'm writing, you're reading. If I know what it's about, then I'm just kind of backing up the manure truck filled with my meaning and saying, dear reader, stand there a second while I administer this, you know, nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. But if we're in it together and we're both looking at the story and sensing the subtle energy that comes off it, then it can be a really intimate, thrilling kind of a deal.
I like the meaning equals manure equation.
Yeah.
I must say.
Mine usually does. I don't know.
So what is intentional about it?
For me, it's the iterative quality. In other words, if I go through a story 400 times, by the end of it, it's kind of like I approve this message. You know, I couldn't probably predict all the valences that it will have for you, but basically I've approved every single thing in there down to the comma. and I like it. And so that level of intentionality is iterative, and it's a little bit, again, below the surface. Once you read a story 400 times and have made those countless choices, there's more of you in there than you could have intended to put in there at the beginning.
In writing an individual story, can you have more than one going?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And actually, I've had, maybe recently I had a blank table, but back to 1988, I had stuff going on in an unbroken line. Because I really dread that moment when you have nothing going on. Because at that moment, that's when you're liable to say, well, what am I really writing about? Or what's my purpose? And then, you know, that way madness lies. So I try to have four or five things going at once. And then really just go in the morning and say, are any of you guys going to be any fun? And hopefully one of them goes, well, I might be a little fun. And then you just pull that one forward and start goofing around with it a little bit.
And then is there a point where you say, okay, I'm going to commit to you?
Yes, that's exactly what happens. A story will sort of be giving you a lot, and you can sort of feel that it's full and it's ready to be finished. And then you'll put the other ones aside for a while and just try to get that done. And then sometimes you'll hit a wall with that one and set it aside. But for me, the trick is to kind of put fun first. It should be enjoyable. It shouldn't be rocket science. It shouldn't be dreadful. It shouldn't be terrifying. It should be kind of enjoyable for you as a reader and hopefully for the writer.
George Saunders is the author of the story collection, 10th of December. It is published by Random House. I want to read a sentence from the first story, Victory Lap. Kissing him last night at the pep rally had been like kissing an underpass. Scary. Kissing Matt was suddenly this cow in a sweater is bearing down on you who will not take no for an answer, and his huge cow head is being flooded by chemicals that are drowning out what little powers of reason Matt actually did have. When you talk about fun, is it fun to write a sentence like that?
Very fun. Yeah, that whole story was a riot. I do this thing that I think of as third-person ventriloquist, where it's kind of a classic third-person stream of consciousness, except you agree to be constrained by the diction and thought patterns of your character. So in that case, it's a 15-year-old girl. And so it's really fun to be, you know, a 97-year-old dude and sort of go, okay, I'm going to now channel my 15-year-old girl. And you can, you know, it's weird because you can do it. You can actually find the corresponding voice or a corresponding voice. So yeah, nothing but fun.
And what is interesting in that story, isn't so many of the stories, is there's so much going on in that head. There's so much rattling around.
I love that as a source of prose. What could be better than the cacophony of your own brain, you know? And I think it's been fun for me as I've worked with this technique to kind of go, well, all right, let's just see in 10 seconds of sitting here what actually is going on in the brain. And it's amazing the things that, you know, you get bursts of childhood memory and little flurry of paranoia. And, you know, I mean, it's endless what can go on in the human mind.
So in reading this, I was wondering if that makes you a keen observer or a keen observer of language and of words. And is there a difference?
I think that's a great question. I think there's not a difference, actually. You are a keen observer. You're a keen observer of language. You're a keen generator of language. And all of that amounts to a kind of awareness of something. I don't know exactly what. And in some ways, it shouldn't, you know, it's funny, fiction shouldn't really make sense. You've got me channeling a 15-year-old girl, which I'm inventing. I'm channeling my own 15-year-old girl. And then I'm making things happen to her. Why in the world would that be of interest? But somehow there's something magical in that observational state that I think it makes a bridge between you and another person. And why, I don't know. But having been the recipient of it, you just sort of trust it, I guess.
Having read your previous collections, it seems as though, and I guess this would be natural, that there is a maturity and a level of, I've read in many of the reviews the term dark, that would be a dark turn, right? or even begin in a dark place and then move. But there seems to be a great deal of heart in these stories that perhaps was not as large in previous stories.
Yeah. I think you're just right. And I don't, you know, that darkness thing, I kind of struggle with it because I don't feel at all that life is a dark proposition. But a story is not a mirror. You know, a story is a game. And so it's a game that starts with a what if proposition. What if a guy turned into a bug? The what if doesn't tell you much about the writer's life view. But what happens after that does. So in Kafka, the fact that he posits that Gregor turns into a bug may or may not mean anything to Kafka. But then in the next beat, you know, Gregor wakes up, he sees he's a bug. He doesn't say, oh my God, I'm a bug. He says, oh my God, I'll be late for work. And suddenly then you've got a story that's about something. So for me, the darkness is just kind of an offset that I, maybe because I'm not very subtle, you know, for me, I want something to happen dramatically, so I make it dangerous, or I make it the worst day of a character's life, or, you know, there's a potential for the baby to go off the cliff. That doesn't, to me, say anything about worldview. But then what happens afterwards? How does the person respond in that moment of great peril or darkness or whatever? That's where I feel more of myself coming in. And as you said very correctly, as I'm getting older, I find myself more interested in the response that's not catastrophic. When something arises in a person that allows them to transcend a situation, that's kind of more interesting to me, maybe. And I don't think I really know why. I think it's partly just maturing, but it's also artistically, you know, it's almost like you're exploring a house. The house is your talent, and you work through the lower rooms first. And as you get older, you're like, well, I've already been down to the second floor. I got to come up. Mm-hmm. And for me, the coming up somehow involves trying to avoid sentimentality or kind of false uplift, trying to really say, all right, what is it like here on Earth? Is it really the case that everything sucks and we're all full of dread and we're mean whenever we can be? I haven't experienced that. On the other hand, is it the case that everybody is a perfectly polite, wonderful human being who always does the right thing? No. So the truth is somewhere in the middle there, and I think I'm just trying to find the correct mix of those two things, maybe.
I find that fascinating about that balance, and let's use the first story that we talked about, Victory Lap, as an example, because that's a wrenching story. And yet at the end, there is this ray of hope. And to me, it seems as though you very much have beautifully achieved that balance. How much did you have to fight and say, okay, I don't want this to have a false uplift?
A lot. I had to fight a lot. But what's interesting is you do that fight not on a philosophical level, but on a practical level. Without giving that story away, there's a thing that has to happen for it not to be the worst nightmare ever. And I was in a period there where I was like, well, if I can make it happen convincingly, then it happened. If I can't, then it didn't. It's almost like going before a judge. The story is the judge. And you say, Your Honor, I present this information in page 1 through 9. Is there any way we can avoid this catastrophe? And the story thinks about it for a while, you know. And the way it decides is when you go to write the, in this case, a sort of a rescue, it either comes off or it doesn't. And I had several passes where it didn't. It was impossible. You felt the writer straining to make a happy ending, and it was BS. So that's really interesting to say, please don't let the story end terribly. I don't want to write that story. But you do have to submit to the authority of the court, go through the process of writing many, many drafts. In that case, that felt like the most fair, you know, because in a certain way, when you're writing a story, the potential for bullying is very high. You know, I set up the thing. I set up the pins, basically. And if you do that, you know, you can set up the pins to make a terribly, terribly disturbing, terrifying, horrible thing. So you have all this control. So I think the perfect story is somehow a pretty good, if distorted, scale model of the balance between dark and light, you know, so that both those things are vital, they're kind of energetic and alive, and they fight, they spar in a realistic way. And then sometimes the dark wins, sometimes the light wins.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, then it is the story that is the judge and jury.
It is a story, because if I set up a story that is, once upon a time, there was a baby crawling near a cliff on a surface that was slanted nearly up and down, and the surface was made of ice, and there's a 300-mile wind blowing the baby towards the cliff, and the baby's wearing ice skates on both hands and feet. Well, okay, so really, you know, with that setup, if the next line is, but the baby rose and skated into the 90-mile-an-hour wind and won the Nobel Prize, something in us, you know, doesn't like that. So when you're working on a story, I think one of the things is for it to be interesting, it has to be possible that the baby would escape the cliff. It has to be kind of viable. So part of it's in the setup, and then part of it's in the delivery. But we get bored with stories that are foregone conclusions. So it seems to me that one of the things you're doing is trying to put the story and the character in a place where they might be saved, but it's not a given.
I read a review that talked about your use of dehumanizing institutions and the struggle that these characters have against them, which seems, again, going back to what we were talking about before, seems much darker than what is afoot here.
Yeah,
but I guess it is a way of explaining it.
I mean, this sounds kind of crass, but it's funny. A dehumanizing institution is funny.
You know, it is funny.
It's really funny, because then you can feel, like in that example at the baby, it's kind of funny to think of a baby trying to skate uphill. And I think all of us have been in institutions that are dehumanizing, whether they meant to be or not. I mean, that's sort of the definition of an institution. So I certainly don't think today I'm going to write I'm going to get back at those dehumanizing institutions. You know, I think as a writer, especially a fiction writer, you're kind of scanning for emotion, scanning for something that matters, because you know the story should have something to do with something that matters in order for it to get purchased. So for me, class is a huge one. Money and the shortage of same is, because it has been in my life, it's interesting. Also, institutions are, because I have found myself working for these big institutions and feeling the stress of that and a lot of emotion associated with that. So I think you're going to tend to write about the things that have caused you the most emotional energy, you know, in your life, and that's one of them for sure.
Having heard you speak, I find it interesting when you talk about your background and you say things like, I was an engineering student and I worked at a slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. It's that background that is so interesting for you then to go to Syracuse University, mm-hmm. work with Tobias Wolff,
yeah.
and remain there.
I was lucky enough to burn through a lot of phases pretty quickly when I was a young person. I have regrets, because I think if I had been better educated in writing and reading, I might have done more. But also to have gotten that kind of strange education and to have come at writing from kind of a weird side room has been also, I think, productive in some ways, you know, because I'm basically always struggling against my sort of handicaps as a writer. And sometimes if you do that, you can blunder into something that hasn't been done before just because you don't know how to do it correctly.
What do you see as handicaps?
I didn't go through a period, for example, when I was in my 20s, I wasn't reading all the great novels and discussing with people who knew what the heck was going on. I was in engineering school. So I was reading kind of slipshod, whatever would present, I would read it and not have anyone to talk about it with. So I think one of the things that novelists do is that they have sort of taken those novels in, many novels, early, in that sort of early 20s rush of energy that you have, so that it almost becomes an intuitive mode of discourse. Just like musicians, you know, like the great musicians, they were playing since they were young. It's second nature for them. I missed that step. I did it a little bit with the story, kind of on my own, but that is a handicap. So I think in some ways, confidence, you know, I don't really have, I'm kind of a control freak, partly because I can feel like I have a very thin ledge of talent. I don't want to fall off. So the way that I've been able to do that is to just rework things really hard and be very, very self-doubting about the finished product. So I think the energy that says, I'm going to write a 900-page novel about this studio, ha-ha, you know, I don't have that.
So when you teach your students, do you want them to read excessively, and or do you want them to be a little bit of a control freak?
Yes. Both. You know, at Syracuse, this year we got 560 applications for 6 spots.
Wow.
So those kids have already read excessively, if that's their tendency. They already know very well about control. So there, it's a kind of a different deal. You know, you're getting a fully formed artist, and you're just trying to put a little cap on his head. You know, I mean, they're already so good that it's more kind of like vaguely psychological work, where you're trying to get them to do the thing that nobody else can do, the one weird thing that only they can accomplish. And that's, you know, that's really heady territory. It's kind of hard to...
But you have to identify that, don't you? Or identify with it, right?
Yeah, you have to identify with it. And I think you have to also, you can note it when somebody's in a dead zone, you know, when somebody has a talent for X and for some reason they're just assiduously avoiding doing X. You can notice that. And then there are kind of skillful ways you can take down that scrim that they put up, you know, or you can say, you can call somebody on their high level nonsense. For example, a lot of times at that level, I was sure doing it, you get somebody who's using their skills to imitate somebody else. So for example, David Foster Wallace is somebody that,
right.
That's a real easy fix. You know, you just basically don't go nuts over the piece, and you kind of say, yeah, you know, it's a pretty good David Foster Wallace imitation. Any writer who hears that you've just cured them, you know, just by sort of gently underscoring it, they won't want to go back to that. Or they might say, well, I don't think so. I think it's different. Good. And if they can make a case, then you can say, oh, that's amazing. Yeah, let's try to go into that room a little more. Let's pull out of the hallway and get into that room that is uniquely you. So, and they're very, very receptive to that. They're totally, you know, hungry for that kind of correction.
When you have success like this with 10th of December, do you think of how you're going to follow it up?
I worried about the first couple of weeks. It has a funny effect. But then also I've been doing it a while. So I just finished up a little story the other day. And being back in there, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, that doesn't. I think part of the process all these years has been to ignore a bunch of outside stuff, whatever it was, whether it was my boss, you know, or, you know, after the first and second book, the same thing happens. You know, you do something, it goes well, and then you tense up. And so I'm kind of familiar with the process.
George Saunders' new book is 10th of December. It is published by Random House. George Saunders, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much and wish you all the luck in the world.
Pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.